Okay, I guess it's almost lunchtime, so I'll try to keep it short. Since I'm going to talk about audio and sound signal processing, you'd better be well-fed so that you can listen. Okay, according to the French proverb, ventre affamé n'a pas d'oreille. If you're hungry, you cannot listen to anything. I will try to be as fast, to go fast. So first, I have to acknowledge the help of many people for this presentation. Most of them are PhD students listed on the left, and some collaborators from EPFL in Switzerland and University of Aalborg on the most theoretical aspects of this research. And of course, I also need to thank the organizers of this colloquium for inviting me to participate in this first session. So, as I said, I'll be talking about audio signal processing. And to give you a hint of what kind of problems we're investigating, I would like to start with some kind of a game. So, your goal will be to find what sound I'm playing and where it is playing. So where, well, it's not going to be too difficult. It's going to be on one of these, well, on these two loudspeakers. And the first thing I will play, the first sound I will play, I guess most of you could, well, I hope most of you can identify that it's a piano. You have a good culture. It's the, from a such a short abstract. So this is a piano, and it's supposed to be played, well, it's played more on louder on this loudspeaker than on this one, so you should hear on the rather on your left. And this other sound, well, this is clear, this is cello, and this is Bach. And this was played on the right loudspeaker. And so if we play all these together, so suppose that these all these instruments play together in the same room, this is what you would hear. Well, I have to admit, this is not music. This is just a mixture of music. But that's not my point today. So if you, since you've heard cello and you've heard piano and you know more or less these instruments and they're not played at the same place. If you want to focus your attention, well, I play this. If you want to focus your attention on the cello, you should be able to do it, maybe with better loudspeakers, by focusing on where this is played and by recognizing the timbre of the cello. Actually, you're using what is called listening cues. First cue, the timbre, which is based on several different frequency patterns, etc., and you also to identify where this this sound is played. You use some kind of spatial cues, the direction where it comes from, and this is based on two types of cues: the difference in the time of arrival to your left ear and your right ear, and the difference between the level at which the sound is perceived on the two ears. So I have a slight example to show you the effect of the difference in level. So this is the same piano sound. If played on your left, it's okay. I knew there was something wrong. It's easier. In real life, it's easier with loudspeakers to move the piano from the left of the room to the right than with a real piano, of course. Okay, and if the piano moves to the right, then you will hear more it more on the other loudspeaker. And this is simply because it's played louder here than it's played with the same loudness on the two loudspeakers, and with louder on the other loudspeaker. Okay. Okay, back back to our problem. So this was the kind of problem that one can easily solve, focusing on the spatial sounds by simply using some listening cues. But what about a computer? If we make a recording with two microphones and we try to analyze this recording, this sound recording, and we would like to extract the sound, let's say, from the cello, how can we help the computer do that? This is the question we'll try to partly answer during this talk. So to get to this, we'll first have to make a very simple acoustic model of what's going on when several sounds are playing in the same room. Then we'll see that this model leads us to a very simple linear algebra, and we'll see some problems. Then we'll see how time frequency masking and some other wavelet-based techniques can help solve the problem. So let's try to model what's going on in a room when several sounds are played and recorded. So the most simple model is the linear instantaneous mixture model, which consists simply in saying that if a cello is playing, then both of your ears receive the same signal, but with different levels, with different intensities. And if another instrument is playing, then the sound is added to your two ears. And if a third instrument is also playing, there's again addition of the received signals. So what is received by your left and your right ears are two time series, two signals that can be simply modeled as linear combinations of the signals produced by the sources in the room. So typically, this will take a matrix form. So what you observe, a signal B of T, is the product of something you don't know, a mixing matrix, which indicates somehow the locations of the sources in your room, and something you don't know either, which is the signals produced by the instruments in the room. So somehow you want to factor something that you observe into the product of two matrices which you don't know. How can you do that? Well, the standard approach, which is the one used in independent component analysis, which was the first historical tool to perform to solve this problem called blind source separation. And the typical approach is to estimate the mixing matrix A by some independent component analysis, and then invert the system of linear equations to recover the remaining unknowns, the sources. Here, we will not really focus on how to estimate the mixing matrix, but let's see what happens. How do we invert this linear system? Well, I guess we're, for many of you, maybe linear algebra 101 is far, but most of you still know how to solve these kind of problems, at least when the mixing matrix is square and invertible, then we all remember there's a unique solution, and we get it by applying the inverse of the mixing matrix. Now, if there's more equations than unknowns, so if the mixing matrix has this rectangular shape with, suppose that you have observed, you have recorded five channels and you have two sources, then there's at most one solution of this to this problem, and you can recover this solution or by applying the so-called pseudo-inverse or the more Penrose pseudo-inverse. Now, in the example that I've just shown, where you have three instruments playing in a room and two microphones or two ears, there's less equations than unknowns. So we are faced with something which is called an underdetermined linear system. And in such a system, there are infinitely many solutions. So we are faced with a new problem, which is even if we know the mixing matrix, we have to choose one solution in this infinite set of possible solutions. And which one will we choose? Well, we need some a priori knowledge on the sources to find something that will sound like the instruments that we're looking for. So back to the problem of building an algorithm that will implement in on a computer and to separate the three sources that we've heard. What we want to do is plug in the algorithm, some knowledge on the structure of the sources, and a typical, well, maybe the most common technique that is used to perform, to invert such non-inversible linear systems would be to apply, again, a pseudo-inverse. And this corresponds to assuming that the sources, the only thing we know on the sources is that they have a small energy, a small L2 norm. What would this give if we try to estimate the cello by applying this pseudo-inverse? So this corresponds to taking what was recorded on the left channel, what was recorded on the right channel, making some appropriate linear combination so as to enhance the cello as much as you can. But as you can hear, there's still a lot of the other instruments, in particular the drums. So it's not so minimizing the energy is not a good a priori. It's not a good strategy to solve this underdetermined system with this kind of sources. So now we'll see what kind of a priori could be chosen, typically for audio sources, to make the separation. And we actually have to solve several steps. We need to estimate a mixing matrix. We need to locate the sources in the recording based on the stereo recording. And we need to choose the right a priori to make this inversion. So what we the acoustic model tells us that what we observe on the left is the product of a mixing matrix and three audio signals that we don't know. Well, this is difficult. There are too many sources. But what happens if let's see a very simple model. Suppose that only one source is active. You had hired three players to play your recording, but two are on strike. So only one of them is playing, and from your recording, let's try to see if you can recover it. So what one can do is a simple scatter plot. At each time, we will plot in 2D the value on the left channel and the value on the right channel. So at different times, we'll see that they are lined. And the direction of this line corresponds to the first column of the mixing matrix, because only because in this product, everything will be proportional to the first column of the mixing matrix. And if you change which players are on strike compared to those who are not, you will obtain two other lines. And by using these lines, you could estimate the mixing matrix and recover your sources. Actually, here you don't have to do much to recover the sources because they are already the only one playing. Now, the problem is that in real life, in practice, well, if you're lucky, everybody is playing. And this is the kind of scatter plot that you observe. So there's absolutely nothing to show you where are the sources, and simply because everything is playing together. So what shall we do? We shall try to change the way we represent the signals. Here, there are time series, and we'll change our representation so that in some sense, at each time or at each place, there's only one instrument playing. So what we have seen is that if we have three sources on a recording, and if at a given time only one of them is playing, we could try to perform some segmentation, determines time segments where only one source is active, based on statistical models or whatever. And after having simply cut the signal into pieces, we can recover each source easily. Well, another situation maybe one can find in telecommunication is we have maybe only one recording of three superimposed sources. but each of them can live in a different frequency band. So if they live in different frequency bands, it's sufficient to filter them out to low pass, middle pass, high pass, and then you can recover each of the sources. Well, the idea to separate sound sources that are mixed together will simply be to mix the time approach and the frequency approach and to make some kind of time frequency decomposition. And the fact is that when you take audio sources, most of the time it's true that in a given time frequency location, only one source is playing. And this will help a lot separating them. So probably there are many people in this audience that are not familiar with time frequency representations, but maybe you can think of when you do a French dressing, take oil and vinegar, and you mix them together. And if you shake you look at it from afar, it just looks that everything is mixed everywhere. But if you take the right instrument to analyze it, you take a microscope, then some places there are essentially oil and some places there is essentially vinegar. And by maybe using the different color of the vinegar and the oil, you will be able to separate the two. Well, here, time frequency analysis is just another tool that replaces microscope to make the separation. So what time frequency analysis does is start with a pair of signals recorded on two channels, use the short time Fourier transform to get two other sequences of values organized with time on the x-axis and frequency on the y-axis, and the color just displays the magnitude. And now, instead of making a scatter plot for a given time, we'll make a scatter plot for a given time frequency points. And if we make this kind of scatter plot, this is what we observe. Here, the directions of the mixing matrix can be observed because essentially one source is active at each time frequency point. Then one can use some clustering algorithm, and here I display the result of the one by Simon Arboret, who was on a master internship last year and is beginning a PhD. So you can take the scatter plot. Once you have you found the directions, you color in blue, green, red, the points that correspond to that are closest to one direction. And now you can take these points and find back to which time frequency points they correspond. So you found the directions, and take, for instance, the set of blue points. Well, they correspond to some time frequency locations. And now you can reconstruct a signal by using only these time frequency locations. You make a reconstruction by the so-called inverse short time Fourier transform and estimate the sources this way. Well, do you trust me that this works? Well, if you don't trust me, let's listen to the kind of results that we can obtain. So I'm not going to go through how the sources are mixed once more, but given a stereophonic recording, we want to separate them. So the first thing, we'll try to do it with the pseudo-inverse technique that I gave you a short example a few minutes ago. And now let's, this was the cello that we tried to recover with the with this linear combination of two channels. Let's try to hear what this would give for the drums. Well, if I didn't tell you these are two different sounds, you would not have heard the difference. So let's try to see if we get something better with the other technique. So all these steps, estimating the mixing matrix, clustering, etc., this is called the DUET algorithm. DUET is a nice acronym for musical sound separation. It stands for degenerate, unmixing, and estimation technique. So DUET gives this estimation of the cello. The drums are estimated like that. So we can compare these sounds to the original sounds on the left. Let's say for the piano. So will you agree with me that, well, this gives quite a better separation of the instruments than with a linear combination of the left and the right channel? This is not high fidelity sound reproduction, but for the task of simply focusing on a given source, this is already quite good. So, to conclude, by using a time frequency representation and clustering algorithms, it's possible to help to build an algorithm to focus on a given source in a recording. Well, that's a conclusion, but didn't I forget something? Well, okay, I will not cheat. I will try to talk to you a little bit about wavelets. So now we'll try to analyze a bit more what was the role of the time frequency representation used for this audio signal analysis. If we look at if we take the recording and make a histogram of the coefficients, this will be essentially a Gaussian histogram for audio signals. And this corresponds to the fact that, well, many values are non-zero. There's no place where we can actually assume that one source is active and the other are zero. And if we go in the time frequency domain, well, the histogram is quite different. Most values are around zero, so there's a high peak around the zero value in the histogram, and some of them are quite high. So, well, this is closer to what is called a Laplacian histogram, and this is what is called sparsity of the coefficient. Sparsity of the time frequency representation means that most values are zero, and few of them are significant. And the relation between the time frequency representation of a source and its time representation is that one can recover the time signal and play it by making a linear combination of so-called time frequency atoms using these coefficients. And the sparsity of the representation means that you can recover a signal by using very few atoms. So it's actually interesting to get sparse representations, let's say, of audio signals because, well, it helps separating them. It can also help compress, represent them with a few, the superposition of a few terms. It helps using a few bits to encode it. But using time frequency atoms might be good for, while it might be good for audio signals, it's not necessarily good for other types of signals. If you want to analyze electrocardiograms, electroencephalograms, or maybe all sorts of signals, it's not necessarily going to be the case that time frequency atoms provide sparse representations. So there's been quite a lot of other representations. Some people now call them starlets because of the wavelet trend, many new representations have the let suffix. And, okay, which one are we going to choose for the rest of this presentation? None in particular, because I'm not going to focus on a particular new tool. I'd rather like to give you a hint of what can be done with this kind of representation of signals or images. Well, in each case, a representation is based on the definition of a family of atoms or elementary waveforms. Many times this family, phi k of t, is a redundant family that tries to match as well as possible every feature that is typical in the class of signals that are analyzed. And one of the goals is to get sparse representations of a class of signals. So again, the idea is that for each signal that you want to represent, it should be a linear combination of the atoms with most coefficients CK close to zero or zero, and only few of them significant. So it's possible to rewrite this in matrix form, and by simply transposing, you might see that we're getting back to the linear algebra formulation at the beginning. So if we want to match as well as possible all the features of the signals that we analyze, we have to add a lot of waveforms in this dictionary of waveforms. So it's going to be redundant. So the matrix is going to be non-square, and there's going to be infinitely many possible representations of this type. But we are not interested in all the representations with the same interest. We want sparse ones. So now we have a criterion, some a priori, to choose which kind of representation we need. Now, the problem is rather which kind of algorithm, which kind of technique to use to choose a representation in this infinitely many solutions. And we have many choices of algorithms. Some of them are really fast, but not sparse. Some of them give something really sparse, but are completely intractable. So first, if we simply make a minimization of the L2 norm, we get a linear algorithm. We apply a pseudo-inverse. Well, this can be pretty fast, but this is absolutely not sparse in most cases. We can try to minimize something that is called the L0 norm by analogy with the L2 norm. Well, I don't know if you have already seen this notation, L0 norm. This is nothing else than the number of non-zero coefficients. So this is something that is quite adapted to measuring sparsity. If you want something really sparse, you need to have very few non-zero coefficients, so the L0 norm should be small. But unfortunately, finding such a representation is combinatorial. What do I mean by combinatorial? Well, basically, the only way to solve this problem is to try to represent your signal with the first atom of the dictionary, then try with the second, then etc. If you've not found an exact representation with one atom, then you try with the first and the second combined, then with the first and the third. You try every pair, every triplet, until you get the an exact representation, and this is how you solve your problem. So since this is not really realistic, it's really difficult to use this approach in practice. Some algorithms that are much better compromise between numerical complexity and sparsity are matching pursuit on the one hand, and L1 minimization. They provide quite sparse representations and quite efficient implementations. So I know Alan Wilsky has worked on some kind of matching pursuit decomposition, and many people in the audience are considering the L1 minimization property. I'm thinking of Jean-Jacques Fuchs in this audience in particular. So now this is what I wanted to let you know about the main challenges of sparse representations. In summary, what can they help for? I've tried to show you some examples, audio examples, to show that they can help a lot to separate sound signals that are mixed together. Now, I've just mentioned that, well, they have some other applications. Typically, they can help to provide good compression of images or signals, and they're used in JPEG 2000, and they're used in MP3, basically in MP3 files. One uses the fact that it's possible to sparsely represent a signal with time frequency atoms. There are some hints now that it's possible to use these techniques in communications too, because in communications it might be the case that you have several possible users that want to emit on a channel, and you will have a few antennas, but you don't want to put too many antennas on your receiver. And even if there's many possible emitters, at most times maybe only a few of them will be active. So that's some field of application where sparsity could come into play. So what are the main challenges? Well, when you're faced with a given type of data that you want, if you want to use sparse representation, the first question you need to ask yourself is, with what kind of waveforms, with what kind of dictionaries, with what kind of starlets are you going to decompose your data? So you want to find something that is adapted to the typical structure that you find in your data. And if you have such a dictionary, now you're faced with yet another problem, is which efficient algorithm are you going to use for that? And of course, you will, depending on your application, you'll need a different trade-off between numerical complexity and sparsity, depending whether you need something online or if you have more time. I would like to get back for a few minutes, just one, to the initial problem of what we could call computer audition. So we've seen that using a simple linear instantaneous mixture model, it's possible to make some analysis and perform source separation. But this is a really, really poor and very simplistic model of acoustics. Because typically when I'm speaking to you, you don't hear just the sound coming directly from my mouth to your ears, but it also reflects on the walls, and there's many reflections that get you to your ears. So in a word, the technical word is to say that the mixture is not instantaneous, it's convolutive. So there's even more underdetermined problems that come into play. And the second thing is that we've used a very crude model. Sparsity is something that is a very basic assumption on the signal to perform separation. But it's possible in many cases to make more sophisticated models, more sophisticated statistical models. And my last slide will give you an example of what can be said, what can be obtained with a slightly more sophisticated signal models. Here, this is an example where it's no longer possible to use the spatial location of a source to recover it, because there's only one recording. It's a monaural recording. And yet, based on some models of the sources that we want to separate, it's possible to separate them. So the signal, the mixture that we want to separate is this one. So this one was not on strike, but I decided to sing. And okay, I don't know if you heard the words in French, but I'm for communism, I'm for socialism. These were the words of Jacques Dutronc, a French singer. And, I'm sorry. And based on statistical models, this is what we can get. Okay. So I thank you for your attention.